Have you ever stood on an airfield and watched somebody about to do something you knew was too dangerous, and they knew it too, and they were going to do it anyway? I've been on that airfield more times than I'd like to admit. Comes with the territory. But the scene I keep coming back to is one I never witnessed personally, couldn't have. I wasn't born yet, and I've read enough about it over the years that I can picture every detail. Oakland, California, August the 16th, 1927. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair because this one doesn't have a happy ending for everybody. Before I get into it, a word from today's sponsor. AviationSoul.com makes aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, commercial certificate. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every one of those milestones is a moment you remember for the rest of your flying life. AviationSoul makes sure you've got something to hold in your hand when you tell the story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, back to Oakland. It had been just under 3 months since Charles Lindbergh set the Spirit of St. Louis down at Le Bourget Airfield outside Paris, and aviation was running a fever that wouldn't break. Lindbergh had crossed the Atlantic solo in 33 and a half hours. Somebody had to cross the Pacific next. That was just understood. It was only a matter of who. The man dangling the carrot was James Dole. He ran the Hawaiian Pineapple Company, the Dole on the grocery store shelf. He announced a prize fund of $35,000 total, $25,000 to the first crew to fly nonstop from Oakland to Honolulu, $10,000 more to whoever came in second, $25,000 in 1927, the rough equivalent of $400,000 today. For one flight, you can imagine what that did to the pilot community. 25 aircraft initially signed up. The problem was that most of them weren't remotely ready for what they were about to attempt. We're talking 1927. Aircraft are wood, fabric, and wire. Navigation consists of a compass, a watch, and whatever radio direction finding equipment you can squeeze into the cockpit if you're lucky. And you're going to fly 2,400 miles over open water. Not the Atlantic, which at least has weather stations and shipping lanes. The Pacific, which in 1927 might as well have been the surface of the moon. Dead reckoning across that much water, with the winds and currents that move over the Pacific, with the navigation technology of the time, gave you a margin of error that could put you hundreds of miles off Honolulu in any direction. And Honolulu from Oakland is a fairly small target when you're running on your last gallons of fuel and hoping the compass hasn't drifted. The press loved it. They called it the Pineapple Derby, the Dole Derby. Crowds drove out to watch. There was a carnival quality to the whole thing that should have given somebody pause. It didn't. By the time the qualifying period ended, only 8 aircraft made it to the starting line. Several others had already crashed during practice runs and qualification attempts. A pilot died during the qualifying period, before the race even began. The warning signs were stacking up the way Cirrus stacks up before a frontal passage, and everyone was looking at the prize money instead of the clouds. Let me tell you who lined up that August morning first. The Woolaraka Travel Air 5000 monoplane, painted red and cream. The name came from a ranch up in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, owned by Frank Phillips of Phillips Petroleum. He'd named the ranch by combining the words woods, lakes, and rocks, Woolaraka. The pilot was Art Goebel, a Hollywood stuntman who had done aerial work for the pictures. His navigator was Lieutenant William Davis, a Navy aviator. Goebel was confident, skilled, and in the weeks before the race, he had done something that most of the other crews hadn't. He sat down and actually learned celestial navigation. That detail is going to matter. Next to them, a plane called the Aloha, piloted by Martin Jensen, a Danish-born pilot who had been living in Hawaii and knew those waters. His navigator was Paul Schluter. Jensen had something most of the others lacked, local knowledge of the destination. Then there was the Golden Eagle, a Lockheed Vega, sleek and fast by the standards of the day, piloted by Jack Frost, an experienced airline man. His navigator was Gordon Scott. And then there was the Miss Doran. The Miss Doran was named for its passenger. Mildred Doran was 22 years old, a schoolteacher from Flint, Michigan. She had no particular aviation reason to be on that flight except that she wanted to be. And the pilot, a man named Augie Pedler, thought her presence would generate publicity. There was a navigator as well, a man named Vilas Knoop. People tried to talk Mildred Doran out of it, her family, other pilots at the field. She would not be talked out of it. She was small. She would not add much to the fuel load. And she had decided she wanted to be part of something that mattered. She was going to be part of something that mattered. Just not the part anyone intended. 4 more planes were at the start line that morning. I'll tell you what happened to them in a moment. The start, August the 16th, early morning, Oakland Army Airfield. Thousands of spectators were out there lining the fence. The air had that California coastal quality, cool and hazy. the smell of salt from the bay mixing with the exhaust of aircraft engines being wound up to full power. 8 planes, their engines roared up one by one, propellers disappearing into their own blur. And then west, out over the city, out over the water, into the sky and the Pacific. The city of Oakland, one of the starters, crashed on the takeoff roll. The pilot walked away. That was luck. Of the 4 remaining starters I haven't named yet, 2 turned back early with mechanical trouble and put it down safely in California. The 3rd was the Dallas Spirit, piloted by a Texan named William Irwin. He turned back due to compass trouble and landed. I'll come back to the Dallas Spirit. That left 4 planes heading west over open water. The Woolerock, the Aloha, the Golden Eagle, the Miss Doran. Now here's where it gets interesting. And by interesting, I mean harrowing. 2,400 miles of Pacific beneath them. In a slow monoplane from 1927, you're looking at somewhere around 25 to 30 hours of flying. You are using dead reckoning. You know your airspeed, your heading, your time aloft. You do the math and you hope the winds cooperate. The winds don't always cooperate. Art Goebel and Lieutenant Davis in the Woolerock had something most of the other crews didn't. Davis was Navy trained in celestial navigation. Star sights at night, sunshots in the daylight. You hold a sextant steady in a vibrating, noisy cockpit. You shoot the angle to the horizon. You work through the mathematics in a logbook on your knee and you correct your heading. It is slow and it is not perfectly precise, but it is a world better than dead reckoning alone across open ocean. Goebel flew that airplane hard and he flew it well. 26 hours, 17 minutes, and 33 seconds after leaving Oakland, he crossed the coast of Oahu and put it down at Wheeler Field. A crowd that had been waiting through the night rushed the fence to meet him. $25,000.
First place. His name in the history books, Martin Jensen and the Aloha, came in about 2 hours after that.
He'd pushed through rough weather over the middle of the Pacific, trusted his local knowledge of the islands, and landed. Second place, $10,000. 2 planes made it, the other 2 were gone. The Golden Eagle with Jack Frost and Gordon Scott, no confirmed distress calls ever came through. No wreckage was found, no oil slick, no life rafts. The Pacific simply took them and gave nothing back. The Miss Doran with Augie Pedler, Vilas Knope, and Mildred Doran. The same story, the same ocean, the same silence. The Navy launched a search ships and aircraft covered that water for days. They found nothing. The search itself was costly. Additional lives were lost in an aircraft accident during the rescue operation. And then William Irwin, the Dallas Spirit pilot, who had turned back safely to fix his compass, heard about the missing aircraft. He and his co-pilot, Alva Harvey, decided they were going back out to look for survivors. They took off again and flew west over the water. The Dallas Spirit also disappeared.
The newspapers that had been so celebratory about the Dole Derby turned on it with force. You had a fruit company executive putting up prize money and crowds cheering while crews were dying in open ocean 300 miles from nowhere. The criticism was ferocious, and most of it was deserved. The government began talking seriously about regulations. The public had been shown the romance of long-distance flight, and now they were seeing the price. Aviation historian Terry Gwynn Jones, who wrote extensively about the transoceanic racing era, described the Dole Derby as a product of gold rush mentality. Everyone wanted to be the next Lindbergh. Nobody wanted to be the voice in the room saying, "Slow down. Think this through. We are not ready for this." And the thing is, Lindbergh himself actually hadn't been reckless. He'd spent months preparing. He selected his aircraft carefully and with purpose. He studied weather and navigation and fuel loads methodically. He thought through contingencies. He was deliberate in a way that many of the Dole contestants simply weren't, partly because prize money and a competition calendar tend to compress the time people spend asking whether they should, in favor of focusing only on whether they can. The race didn't kill the idea of Pacific aviation. It forced it to grow up. Charles Kingsford Smith crossed the Pacific successfully in 1928 with a properly equipped crew and experienced Pacific navigators. Pan American built their transoceanic routes in the mid-30s with rigorous weather forecasting, proper staging, and aircraft design from the beginning for oceanic distances. The road from the Dole Derby to the Clipper era is a short one, and it runs straight through the wreckage of what the Derby left behind. The Woolerock is still with us. You can see it today at the Woolerock Museum up in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. It sits in that building, original wood frame, original fabric, original paint. And you can stand in front of it and try to comprehend what it was like to point that nose at the western horizon in 1927 and just go 26 hours of Pacific beneath you. No land in sight, no navigation satellites, no radar, a compass, a sextant, a logbook on your knee, and whatever faith you could muster that the math was right. Art Goebel had done the work. He learned the navigation, prepared his crew, and he came home.
Mildred Doran was 22 years old and she wanted to be part of something extraordinary. The Pacific is full of extraordinary things. Not all of them come back. I've told this story at a few fly-ins over the years. Folding table, cold coffee, gone to room temperature, other pilots listening. And when you get to the part about the Miss Doran, the room always goes quiet, because every pilot in that room knows the calculation. Knows what it feels like when the want to is pulling harder than it should be. The sky is generous most of the time, but the ocean does not negotiate. Sources for today's segment come from the archives of the Oakland Tribune and the San Francisco Examiner, the historical work of Terry Gwynn Jones on early long-distance aviation, and the Woolerock Museum's documentation of Art Goebel's flight. More at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up.